Good morning. Welcome to the Prison Action Network, produced by the Hudson Mohawk Independent Media Center. I'm Judith, and my guest today is Cheryl Cates, a lawyer in private practice in Rochester, New York, and the director of a nonprofit prisoner advocacy organization called Edge of Justice. Welcome back to the Voices from the Prison Action Network, Cheryl.
Good morning.
Good morning. Why don't you start by telling our listeners a little background? What kind of law do you practice, and what sort of work does Edge of Justice do?
I practice in the area of parole. I do parole revocation hearings. I also prepare parole plans for individuals appearing before the New York State Board of Parole. I do the administrative appeals when someone has been denied parole, and also the subsequent court proceedings, Article 78, and further appeals of a parole denial. I also do some appeals in administrative law regarding the Department of Corrections, Tier 3 ticket appeals, work release denials, and things of that nature. The Edge of Justice, we perform advocacy for inmates. For instance, if we get a health care complaint, sometimes we'll intervene and correspond with the Department of Corrections to attempt to obtain medical care for different inmates. At one time, we were doing transitional programming for reentry, but at this point, we haven't been doing that.
I've never heard of another lawyer with your specialty. You must be in great demand. How do you decide which cases to take?
Well, I don't really turn down many of them. I try to squish them all in, but it has been difficult. I don't know of anyone else that does the ticket appeals.
Yeah.
As far as parole, I know there's a few others that do practice in the area of parole, but they're up in the New York City area.
Mm-hmm. And you're
as a specialty.
Yeah. And what kind of a success rate do you have?
Well, that's the downfall for me. Unfortunately, most of my cases, I never make it into court because they let them go from other interventions. So I don't have many cases on the record showing that I've won because other interventions have happened for me, usually at the administrative level.
Explain. I don't quite...
When you're filing a parole case, you have to exhaust your administrative remedies first. That means an appeal goes into the parole board. And what I've had happen on many of my cases is that they will release my client before I have to go to court intervention or during the process of filing the case, they'll wait until it's filed and then they release them. So I never get a court decision saying that the courts freed them because I've been able to have parole free them. An example of that is my latest case where my client has been incarcerated for 40 years, and we went ahead. I won the case 3 times in the administrative area at parole, and then they sent my client back to the parole board, and they denied him again. So I went ahead and filed a writ of habeas corpus in Washington County, which is a legal action that you complain about constitutional violations and the relief is released. So that was currently pending, and my client went back to the board in February, and he's coming home. So he'll, after 40 years, he's coming home.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I've had a couple of thoughts as you were talking. First of all, you may not have any successes that you can point to in respect to judgments, but it sounds like just the fact that you've been there and you've been taking the case has resulted in people either being freed or being re-examined. Is that right? Is that fair to say?
Yes, I've had a lot of successes with parole plans.
Yeah.
About 7 months ago, one of my clients, a lifer, he was released after I submitted a parole plan for him. I've had quite a bit of success with those.
So how many years have you been practicing law?
since 2003.
Oh, wow. That's only 3 years. You're doing really you're doing really well. And what do you like best about your practice?
Excuse me. I like the feeling when justice is done. I guess there's no other way to explain that. For instance, when I got the call a week ago that my client was coming home, Carol Taylor. We had been fighting that case for 2 years. There was no reason for them to... I mean, one of the times they denied him parole was for oversleeping at the count. I mean, it was the most ridiculous thing that I had ever seen. And to then have the parole board ignore their own decision, telling them what they had to look at in judging my client for parole, and then have them re-deny him parole... ignoring their own decision was just like a slap in the face, and I was to the point where I was very frustrated, because what was I supposed to tell my client? I had won his case 3 times and he's still sitting in prison. So at that point I said, that's it, we're not playing with them anymore, and we filed a writ in Washington County. And I believe because of all the denials we had, it would have allowed me to cross-examine almost the entire parole board commissioners during the writ if we were granted a hearing. And I believe that's the reason they sacrificed the lamb and let him go to avoid that court appearance.
Uh-huh. I had a little problem following the sleeping, oversleeping thing. Can you go into a little bit more detail? Yeah.
Yes, he was given a disciplinary ticket in regards to interfering with the count because he overslept. And the parole board, I think this was the second appearance. My client was an MPI client, which means his sentencing was a little different than what they have now. He was given a 0 to 9 bid in prison, which means that the parole board, in his circumstance, they have to set the minimum period that he's incarcerated. So there's a different standard for him as opposed to someone else just normally going to parole, because of the fact that they set the minimum period of incarceration, they cannot use serious nature of the crime or criminal history as a reason to deny parole, because they assessed that when they were setting the MPI. So in his case, the first decision, they did just that. They denied him based on those issues. So we raised that issue, and then they gave
excuse
him
me. I lost something there. So what did they set the minimum as?
They screwed everything up, basically. They didn't run the first hearing as an MPI hearing. They ran it as a normal hearing, and they hit him with 24 months. So that was one of the issues we were arguing, is that he was never given an MPI hearing, and they just kept hitting him every time he went to the board.
Okay.
The first time he was hit with serious nature of the crimes and criminal history, which they can't use that for his case because he was an MPI case.
Mm-hmm.
The second time, he had received the disciplinary ticket for oversleeping, for interfering with the count. And in that particular appeal, I was so frustrated that I got really sarcastic in my brief. And in the last argument, I went to quoting things about St. Vitus, the saint of oversleeping, and you know, there were things in there like, you can't fry my client like a popcorn shrimp, because it was a big thing back in history. So I also went and used a study that was done by Czech Cereal indicating that the executives in the country oversleep all the time. So it was like a satire, and we were joking around with them, like, if you even think about letting this go to court, we're going to have a lovely time with you. And they, again, reversed and sent him to a de novo hearing, giving the parole board instructions that they were not to be using that criteria. So again, we go back again, and they denied him again. So at that point, you know, I told them, that's it, we're not playing anymore. And we filed the writ, which is rarely used in parole denials because of the fact that you're not constitutionally guaranteed to parole release. So you have to have a very egregious conditions as far as the parole board not following their own regulations to even get through the original threshold to even have a writ heard.
Mm-hmm. But it was heard.
But at that point, when we had filed, our writ was pending. We had made it through the first threshold where they didn't throw us out of court with the writ, and they allowed the Attorney General's office to answer the petition, and I had submitted a reply, and we were waiting for a response from the court in Washington County at the time that my client reappeared before the parole board.
Mm.
And like I said, they released him, so I'm assuming they did not want me to have the opportunity to cross-examine the majority of the parole board, because I was planning on questioning them about their policies and, you know, no parole for violent felony offenders and a lot of other things. And I think it was safer for them to sacrifice the lamb and let my client go, so we didn't have all of that information on the record.
Okay. Now I understand.
And
I want to remind our listeners at this point that this is Voices from the Prison Action Network, and our guest is Cheryl Cates, a lawyer from Rochester, New York. And Cheryl, you had another case, I think, that you were interested in telling me about, and I decided to have you tell me about it on the air so we could more people could hear. Is that right?
Okay. That case is Bottom versus New York State Board of Parole. I will be arguing this case in the Third Department Appellate Division on March 28th at 1:30 in the afternoon.
And where is that court?
It's in Albany, New York.
Okay, so why don't you just give that information one more time in case there's people, because this is a Capital District area, and maybe there's people who would like to listen to you do that. Do you know what time it is?
It's at 1:30.
Mm-hmm.
1:30 on March 28th in the Third Department Appellate Division. So this will be my first appearance there.
Okay. Go ahead. Tell us what's going to happen then on March 28th. How much can you talk about before you actually argue it?
I can talk about anything. All the paperwork is in, so it's all in.
Okay.
My client is Jahlil Montequim, a.k.a. Anthony Bottom. He was one of the New York Three. He's a Black Panther member, and we consider him as a political prisoner. He's currently serving 25 to life, and he was convicted of two counts of murder where two police officers were killed. This is why he's considered a political prisoner. His arrest came out of the COINTELPRO program that was run by Hoover and the FBI. This was a program fashioned to break up the Black Panther Party and other radical groups at that time. And he has maintained his innocence throughout his 29 years of incarceration in New York State for this crime. So that's another issue that we have. He initially appeared before the parole board in 2002, where he was denied parole based on the serious nature of the crime and criminal history, which in his case they can legally do because he's not an MPI candidate. He also reappeared in 2004, and he was also denied for the same reasons, for serious nature of the crime and criminal history. To give the listener some background, when a person appears before the parole board, it's a statutory mandate which the parole board is supposed to consider when they're reviewing someone's case for parole release. It's found in New York State Executive Law 259I, Section 2CA. And there's a list of things they consider, one being the institutional record, release plans, if someone participated in a temporary release program, also if there was a victim impact statement, which has been a hot issue lately due to two cases where they didn't allow the victims to make impact statements, and then when they found out people were being granted parole, they stepped up and they were like, hey, wait a minute, we didn't know about this. The one case is Cynthia Pugh. Her conviction was out of Syracuse, and they rescinded her parole based on a victim impact statement that was given later. So that's supposed to be a big issue. The reason I say supposed to be, in my case that I'm arguing, my client, we had one of the victim's sons in New York City at a press conference. He also gave a victim impact statement arguing for my client's release. But they ignored this factor. The state, across the state, they've been denying parole to people with A1 felonies. And a very big expose set of articles was published on January 31st, 2006 in the New York Law Journal. And part of the information that was released in those articles is between 2004 and 2005, only 3% of all A1 felons that appeared before the board were released. So as opposed to, I believe the figures in 94, 95 were 15%, and prior to Pataki coming into office, it was much greater. But it's been diminishing every year since he's taken office, to the point where, at least I'm hearing from everyone, that nobody has any hope when they go to parole because of the small numbers of people being released. And it's very frustrating, and in this case that I'm arguing as well, the parole board seems to be ignoring all the factors that's contained in the statute, including someone's institutional record, their release plans, and things of that nature. For me, looking at these cases, it's very disgusting to me because you can't take back the crime. It's already done. It's happened usually 2 or 3 decades prior to them appearing before the board. People that have been incarcerated, they're not the same people. Yet the parole board has consistently been denying parole based on the serious nature of the crime, which is a factor that nobody can change.
I think I read, and maybe you did too, an article about a judge who protested about that and said it was taking discretion from the judges away, and he mandated the parole board to bring back the person and consider all those other things. Do you know anything about what I'm talking about?
There's so many cases that have come down, so unless you know the name of the case, yeah. I don't know.
Okay, to me, I thought it sounded to me like that was a rare situation that a judge had told the parole board that they had to, that they hadn't looked at all the circumstances of how the person had changed and that they had to go back and re-interview him and consider those things. But that happens?
Yes, the legal standard, in order for your case to even be heard in an Article 78 proceeding, you have to show that their decision was irrational, bordering impropriety. And this is something that I'm arguing on the 28th, because if you go back in the history, and this is a complicated discussion, but if you go back in the history of our country, even the founding fathers, when they were writing the Constitution and setting up the laws for the United States, they wanted to have 3 separate branches of government.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back in that analysis, there is no place for this type of action that we're having from the parole board. The parole board is an executive agency, but yet they're being allowed to function in a quasi-judicial capacity, meaning that they hold the key to someone being able to be released. And that's not consistent with the laws of our country. That's a judicial function. And then to turn around and say, okay, now you're coming into court to ask me to review the discretion of the parole board, but I can't. So the issue we have is an issue of separation of powers. And I'll be arguing that on the 28th. The other thing in this particular case, to me, that was just really shocking that nobody paid attention to in the lower courts was the fact that we had a lot of erroneous information in my case. For instance, when we received the original appeal decision from the parole board at the administrative level, they sent my client's decision. The front page wasn't even his case. It was a case of a sex offender, and we think that they didn't review his material when they made the decision. We think it was a mistake, and they read whoever this person was, his information, and then rendered a decision and sent it to my client. That was the first issue. Then when the lower court, in the trial court, when they reviewed this case, in the decision itself, the judge was speaking about my client's crime and made reference that my client stabbed his victim. And in this particular case, it was involving a shooting.
Ah.
Yeah, so I mean, those issues alone opened the door for us in that how can they say they reviewed my client's case in the first place when they have stuff that's not consistent with his case?
Wow. So that's what you're going to be using that in your argument.
Yes.
Yeah.
Going back to what we were talking about the legal standard of irrational bordering impropriety, there's been four cases that have come down, I want to say within the last year, analyzing what that means, because when you start to do the research on this issue to file a case, the older cases that they often rely on, the Silman case and Russo is another case, they don't really explain what irrational bordering impropriety means. So it makes it very difficult for you to make that argument because there's not a clear definition of that phrase. And that's the standard you have to meet for the court to even review your case. The four decisions, in case anyone, I'll give the names of them, I don't have the citations in front of me, in case anyone wants to check out the cases. There was, I think it's Marino, Wallman, Capiello, and Weinstein. These are four cases that are fairly new that deal with the issue of irrational bordering impropriety. And those are the major case law that I relied upon in my brief and my appeal that kind of describe what irrational bordering impropriety means. And it usually, you know, it goes back to whether they followed the rules of the statute. And, I mean, there's been a big wave changing the way we look at parole decisions. I think the first case that started it was the Chan case, which we're all pretty much familiar with because there was so much publicity about that case. But it all goes down to the same thing. It is not right for the parole board to be implementing Pataki's plan to end parole for violent felony offenders for people that have been convicted of crimes 20, 25, 30 years ago. That's not consistent. And I don't know much about it, but there has been a class action filed in regards to the parole board's activities in New York State.
Uh-huh.
So hopefully, you know, we'll get some relief from that. And like I said, I really don't know much about that case, but I do know it has been filed.
Uh-huh. Well, this has been a very informative few minutes. I really find these cases very interesting, and I imagine a lot of our listeners will too. But we're going to have to wrap it up in just a minute or two. Do you have any last words you'd like to say, or do you want to give out your contact information? Or
my contact information is Cheryl L. Cates. My address is 121 North Fitzhugh Street. It's FITZHUGH, Suite 300, Rochester, New York, 14614. And I just want to say to everybody, you can't give up. I mean, the only thing you can hold on to is the fight. And, I mean, it's working, so we have to just keep fighting to change these policies. That's all I can say.
There's one thing you made me think of just now. It's a little late to be bringing it up, but I get many, many requests for the names of lawyers who will work pro bono. Do you ever work pro bono, and what can I tell people who ask that question?
Well, 50% of my caseload is pro bono. However, I receive a lot of requests for help, and it's outside of my area of practice. So I think that's the one thing that people should figure out before they flood offices with mail is, what does this person do? I receive requests from people that want to do appeals and things of that nature as far as 440 motions and things that are outside my area of practice.
Mm-hmm.
And that is frustrating because it's like I can't help them and I want to, but.
Yeah. Well, imagine what I feel like. I'm not even a lawyer, and I hear these cases, and yeah. I just wish I was a lawyer, and I wish I knew more of people. So if anybody's listening who practices law and would be willing to take cases pro bono, I'd like to hear from them. So anyway, thank you very much, Cheryl, for being on the program this morning, and good luck on that case. Maybe some of us will be able to get there and hear you argue it.
Sure. I after I'm done, I'd be willing to talk to anybody when I get out of the courtroom or whatever about the case more if they want to, too. So just if I know who they are, walk up to me and approach me. That's not a problem.
Okay, great. Thanks again. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You too. Thanks.